Welcome, this is Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first story comes from Native News Online. Meet the Native American women taking on the Boston Marathon by Elise Wild. Missy Hendricks, Apache, first race was a 5K through the mountains on the Mescalero Apache Reservation with her dad more than 20 years ago. They woke up before sunrise and drove 100 miles from Las Cruces. Mescalero is on the eastern shoulder of the Sacramento Mountains range and is about 10 degrees cooler. The cold morning air stands out in her memory as she recalls waiting at the starting line, gripped by nerves. "I remember being afraid I wouldn't be able to do it, that I just wouldn't be able to do the mountains," Hendricks told Native News Online. She focused on keeping up with her dad. "I just followed my dad, like, tried to stay with him, and then, like, I got that runner's high," she said. "I felt so good, and I thought, I love this." Now, two decades later, Hendricks is preparing to run the 130th Boston Marathon. She never imagined that running on the res with her dad would lead her to run beside elite athletes in the world's oldest marathon. "I just never thought I'd be good enough, so why even dream that big? I always think back to myself as a little Native girl who thought that she was never going to be seen or ever be in these spaces like that," she said. Native history in the Boston Marathon. The Boston Athletic Association started the race in 1897, a year after the Olympics held its first marathon event. The 26.2-mile-long course has remained largely unchanged since 1924, when the starting line was officially moved to Hopkinton, a small town a marathon's distance east from Boston. One of the most celebrated events in sports culture, it draws tens of thousands of runners and around 500,000 spectators. Native people have been part of the storied race since its early days. Mohawk runner Bill Davis placed second in 1901. 6 years later, his protege Tom Longboat Onondaga won first place, beating the record by 20 minutes. In 1936, Ellison Brown's climb over the leader in the final miles led to the Heartbreak Hill nickname on the Boston course map. That win qualified the Narragansett runner to compete with the U.S. Olympic team in Nazi-occupied Berlin, Germany. He won the 1939 Boston race in 2 hours, 28 minutes, and 51 seconds. Festivities this year will officially display that history during a panel discussion hosted by the Cultural Center and the Boston Athletic Association. Native runners slated to speak include Carissa McKinney, Mashpee Wampanoag, Kristen Wyman, Natick Nipmuc Band, Jordan Marie brings three white horses, Whetstone, Lakota, and Thon Harris, a Narragansett runner also related to Brown. Even so, the race only allowed male competitors for its first 75 years. Catherine Schweitzer made history in 1967 when she registered under a pseudonym and completed the marathon despite a race official repeatedly assaulting her by grabbing her and trying to pull her off the course. 5 years later, Congress passed Title IX, ending sex-based discrimination in sports and officially opening the Boston Marathon to women. Mi'kmaq Nation member and elite runner Patty Dillon is considered to be the first Native woman to run the race, placing second 3 years in a row from 1979 to 1981. It's in our DNA. Many Native tribes' cultures have historic roots in running. According to Indian Running, Native American History and Tradition by anthropologist Peter Nabokov, running was vital to survival, transportation, and communication, with some tribes having networks of dedicated runners to cover long distances to carry messengers. "My people ran everywhere," Hendricks said. "You read about stories where they'd run at least 100 miles a day. They had their messengers before horses were here. That's what we did. We ran, and we knew exactly where the water would be and how far we could make it. For myself, running feels spiritually grounding." Runner and member of the Miami tribe, Molly McGuire, agrees. It's in our DNA, McGuire said. For Native people, it brings us back to a time when running was all we did. It was part of our daily life. Now it's healing for the generational trauma we carry. McGuire is also running Boston. Both women are participating in the race as part of Team Native Women Running, NWR, a nonprofit that elevates the representation of Native women runners by covering race entrance fees and travel costs. Founded in 2022 by ultra runner Verna Nez Begay, Dene, NWR has sponsored Native women in races across the globe. For me, running has always been about community, Nez Begay said. I've lost my 3 siblings and my parents, and that is such a shared experience with a lot of Native women. That comes into play. Every race I run is dedicated to my family members. It's a healing tool. Miles of prayer. Dene runner Angel Jim, Black Sheep Clan, Bitterwater Clan, will be running this year's Boston Marathon to raise money for the Joe Andruez Foundation, a Massachusetts-based nonprofit that provides financial relief to cancer patients and their families. For Jim, running is a ceremony in which she offers her prayers as her feet carry her through the first miles. When I start my run, I start my prayers. Please watch over my mom, my sister, my children. I'm sending all that out to my people, Jim said. Whatever I'm dealing with in life that is causing stress and anxiety, it somehow works its way out during the run. When I'm finished, I'm tired, but I've also got a clearer mind, and I know what direction I need to head. Boston will be Jim's first marathon. Her sister, who works for the Joe Andruez Foundation, has specified Boston, encouraged her to sign up for it. She told me, when you go to a marathon, it really feels like the world is unified for a couple of hours. If she can do it, I can do it. As Hendricks prepares to hit the course on April 20th, she reflects on a childhood spent running alongside her dad, who worked 2 jobs and went to school. Running was a way I spent time with him, she said. Today, Hendricks' dad lives with Parkinson's disease, a progressive nervous system disorder that affects a person's ability to control their movements. I would give anything to go back to those days to run with him, she said. She hopes that her own running journey, which took her from the reservation to Boston, will inspire other young Native girls to see themselves running on the world stage. I hope that some little girl can look up to me and say, if she did it, I can do it too, she said. Elise Wild is senior health editor for Native News Online, where she leads coverage of health equity issues, including mental health, environmental health, maternal mortality, and overdose crisis. Up next, plans to withdraw protections from oil and gas development around Chaco prompt 70,000 public comments to federal agencies in 1 week, by Sean Griswold. A proposal that would expand energy development on 336,425 acres around Chaco Cultural National Historical Park initiated a sudden 7-day public comment period that prompted approximately 70,000 comments on the matter, according to the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. A BLM spokesperson said the federal agency completed the first public comment period on April 7th, and that there will be another opportunity to gather public input on a future draft environmental assessment. The BLM did not share details on the types of comments received or whether it planned to review any National Environmental Policy Act exemption options authorized April 9th by the newly formed Council on Environmental Quality. Native News Online requested the additional information and will update if it is received. The Council on Environmental Quality, created by the White House to execute the administration's energy agenda, has been criticized for gutting longstanding environmental protections. It has also been used to justify emergency procedures that have fast-tracked energy projects despite environmental concerns, such as the Velvetwood uranium and vanadium mine. The most recent round of public comment regarding Chaco started after a federal judge ruled March 31st to settle a lawsuit brought by the Navajo Nation, who claims that a 10-mile buffer zone that restricts oil and gas activity around Chaco violated the tribal sovereignty and mineral rights claims. Attorneys for the Navajo Nation argued the 10-mile buffer zone created economic hardship for up to 20,000 Navajo citizens that receive oil and gas royalties from energy development in the area. The settlement invited the public to comment on reducing the buffer zone to 5 miles, something preferred by the Navajo Nation, eliminate it altogether, or keep the 10-mile buffer enacted by President Joe Biden in 2023. Despite the short notice and small public comment window, several prominent indigenous and environmental organizations activated a response that shared how Chaco remains a culturally significant place for Native Americans that includes historic religious sites, burial grounds, and artifacts connected to the contemporary Pueblo people that live in the region. "We did a 20-year withdrawal of this 10-mile buffer zone for Chaco," Deb Holland told Native News Online. "This conversation shouldn't even be happening right now. I'm appalled by this administration's disregard for sacred land, our people, and our culture." Holland, Laguna Pueblo, administered the protections in 2023 as U.S. Secretary of Interior and is a defendant in the Navajo Nation lawsuit. Regarding Chaco updates, BLM officials said any new information about the future reports or notices for public comment will be posted on the NEPA project page. Sean Griswold, senior reporter for Cultivating Culture, is a Native American journalist based in Albuquerque. Up next, Navajo Nation leaders partner with ASU to strengthen data-driven decision-making, by Native News Online staff. Members of the 25 Navajo Nation Council on Friday welcomed a team from Arizona State University's Decision Theater to explore ways to strengthen data gathering, analysis, and strategic decision-making for communities across the Navajo Nation. Navajo National Council Speaker Crystalline Curley, joined by Council Delegate Amber Kanazba-Crotty and Shandin Parrish, attended the presentation alongside leadership from Diné College, Navajo Technical University, the Navajo Nation Division of Public Safety, and other guests. Decision Theater is an advanced visualization and collaboration environment that combines data analytics, high-performance computing, and interactive modeling to help leaders, policymakers, and researchers address complex real-world challenges. According to Arizona State University officials, the platform translates large data sets into visual, simulation-based scenarios, enabling more informed and effective decision-making in areas such as population growth, public health, education, and environmental policy. Speaker Curley said the Navajo Nation is open to exploring new ways to equip leaders and communities with innovative tools to better understand challenges and identify data-driven solutions. "This is a new way of moving forward, and I'm very grateful to ASU for being here and sharing the technology and expertise they can to bring to the Navajo Nation," Curley said. The Navajo Nation makes up a third of Arizona. Strengthening this connection gives us a real opportunity to close the data gap and better serve our communities. Curley visited the Arizona State University campus in February to learn more about Decision Theater and invited the team to present to the council and executive branch leaders. Michael Henderson, chair of the Diné Action Plan, said early discussions among the plan's four task forces underscored the need for stronger data collection to support effective prevention and outreach efforts. Working with Dr. Ferlin Clark of the Department of Diné Education, Curley supported efforts to bring multiple entities together. Presentations and discussions focused on advancing data modeling and visualization tools to support long-term planning, improve service delivery, and enhance community goals. Crotty emphasized that any data initiatives must respect tribal sovereignty, community input, and the protection of sensitive information. She also made a formal request to Navajo Nation President Bu Nygren to support the Missing and Murdered Diné Relatives Task Force by helping complete a centralized database in partnership with Navajo Technical University. Data is critical to making sure we are taking meaningful action on the issues impacting our communities across the Navajo Nation, Crotty said. I've asked President Nygren to commit his office to dedicating $1 million to complete and finalize the Missing and Murdered Diné Relatives Database, which will be hosted at Navajo Technical University. This effort is about ensuring we have accurate information to support our families, strengthen accountability, and guide real solutions. Nygren confirmed his office will assist in completing the database, commit $1 million to the effort, and direct the Navajo Nation Division of Public Safety to work with Navajo Technical University to finalize the data. The Navajo Nation Council said it looks forward to continued discussions with Arizona State University to identify opportunities for collaboration aimed at empowering communities, supporting leadership, and improving quality of life for Navajo citizens. You're listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Up next, truth and healing can exist in the same space. Native voices rise as U.S. Colorado prepare anniversary commemorations. By Stuart Huntington for ICT News, Indian Country Today. Denver, Colorado turns 150 years old this year, and to mark the milestone and the concurrent 250th anniversary of the founding of the country, the state legislature established a commission to plan a series of commemorative events. And what are Colorado's indigenous communities planning to bring to the parties? The truth. On a bus. We want to talk about what happened, what really happened, and our histories, and bring that into the modern day. And we see how we can heal from this, said Diné artist Nazhoni Morgan, who helped turn an ordinary school bus into a mobile exhibit on Colorado's Native culture and history that will travel the state sharing the stories. I like to think of the bus as a comprehensive Indigenous people's history in Colorado. Dubbed the Breathing Healing Bus, it was created by a community of Native artists, activists, and historians, a project that is set to be formally announced on Monday, April 20th. It grew in part out of the 2023 report of the Native-led Truth, Restoration, and Education Commission, or TREC, that detailed the history of Native people in Colorado. The report identified dozens of Native nations with ties to the Colorado landscape, but highlighted the plight of the 10 federally recognized tribes that ceded land within the state borders, most of whom were driven from their homeland to places such as Wyoming, Montana, or Oklahoma. Today, only the Southern Utes and the Ute Mountain Utes maintain territory on reservations in the state. But despite the severity of the history, the message of the bus project remains, well, healing. Our main goal is to help in the healing process and also to get our people shown in a beautiful light, in a good way, said Sid Whiting, a Lakota citizen. Whiting admitted, however, that that might seem hard to do with this bus, which is focused on the difficult history in Colorado, much of it depicted in the stories and artwork in the bus. Among those stories are the Sand Creek Massacre and the Annihilation of the Buffalo, said Whiting, who is the cultural engagement coordinator with Create Aya, one of the groups behind the bus projects. In 1864, U.S. Army soldiers and Colorado Territorial Volunteers killed more than 230 Cheyenne and Arapaho people over the course of 7 hours in an attack along the Sand Creek in southeastern Colorado Territory, about 170 miles southeast of Denver. Colorado also witnessed the slaughter of thousands of buffalo as part of 19th century U.S. policy to kill off herds as a way to starve and drive off Native nations that relied on the herds for sustenance. You would think that by showing those stark facts, It would really be harmful to people, Whiting said. But people begin to understand their own healing once they see the trauma of others. And that's kind of what we want to accomplish, to begin this healing process by showing what Native people have been through. The converted school bus houses a mobile, immersive art and storytelling experience that centers on Indigenous perspectives, often excluded from official histories. The exhibits combine Native youth artwork, multimedia storytelling, and guided reflection experiences. Visitors can move through a museum-style installation featuring photography, spoken word, interactive art, and audio storytelling that highlight both historic truths and present-day Indigenous voices. Dr. Terry Bissonette, a scholar and educator from the Bay Mills Indian community, is a central figure behind the 2024 Trek Report and the Bus Project. She said she sees hope for positive outcomes from the bus tour for Native communities and for those throughout the state. "We want to show that truth and healing can exist in the same space," she told ICT. "It's extremely important. We don't want anyone to go through this exhibit feeling triggered, traumatized, re-traumatized, or guilty. None of that stuff. We want folks to feel uplifted. We want them to feel inspired. We want them to have a call to action." Echoing one of the recommendations of the Trek Report, Bissonette said she hoped the bus tour sparked support for revising the state's education curricula to more accurately reflect Native experiences. "Native history is Colorado's history," she said, "and it's important for as many people to know and understand that history, because Native people today are at the bottom of every good statistic and at the top of every bad statistic. We don't do well in school. We die young. All of those kinds of things. And it stems from unresolved historical trauma. One of the best ways to combat that is to shine light on it with honest education in our schools so we can confront it and we can all move forward together. And that is really what the ultimate goal is. That goal is not lost on members of the America 250 Colorado 150 Commission, which allocated $7,000 to the Breathing Healing Bus Project in an effort to ensure Native voices were heard during the commemorative events. "We're really interested in understanding how we got to now, and we understand that there are many moments that we don't celebrate that brought us to now," Commissioner Jason Hansen told ICT. "Because we think of this anniversary as a moment to take stock and to look to the future, I think we all want to envision a brighter future." To focus on that future, organizers made sure that youth were part of the project. 16 of the 20 contributing artists are under 30. Through a youth photo mural exhibition, spoken word, and contemporary art installations, the mobile bus exhibit presents present-day Indigenous perspectives, offering not only truth-telling, but vision, resilience, and leadership. Elizabeth Tafoyo, Jicarilla Apache, was one of the youth participants. The multidisciplinary artist shared what she perceives as the central message of the healing bus. "We are still here, even though many people don't understand it or don't want to believe it," Tafoya said. "We're still here." 9-year-old Justin Maldonado, a Northern Arapaho photographer, was more concise. When asked about the message of the bus, Maldonado answered simply, "The truth about Native Americans." For more info, the Breathing Healing Bus will make stops across Colorado starting in late spring as the Colorado 150 and the America 250 events begin to gear up. Its official first stops are scheduled for the weekend of May 9th on the two Ute reservations in southwest Colorado. Additional details about state-sponsored commemorations can be found at the America 250-Colorado 150 Commission. In our final story, Far North Fashion Show Celebrates Alaskan Cultures, by Yareth Rosen for Alaska Beacon. Attendees of the Arctic Encounter Summit held last week in Anchorage took a break from heavy discussions about climate change, national security, shipping safety, and other pressing concerns on Wednesday night to enjoy something more fun, high fashion. Far North Fashion Show, now in its seventh year, showcase the work of indigenous designers from around Alaska. To be honest, the Far North Fashion Show is the highlight of so many attendees' experiences, myself included, said Rachel Callender, Arctic Encounters founder, in brief remarks at the start of the show. The celebration, which featured a catwalk bathed in pastel lights, pulsing music, and refreshments, required a lot of work to pull together, Callender told the audience. We have designers and models who have put in hundreds and hundreds of hours into what you're about to see, she said. Beyond their good looks, the clothing on display incorporated messages. Many were about traditions. Some were inspired by the animals that are important to different indigenous Alaska cultures. A dress designed by Jackie Catalina Schaefer, who is Inupiaq, paid homage to the caribou, for example. Another dress was designed with a train that resembled a whale fluke. And models, as they took their turns on the catwalk, sometimes made moves that are part of traditional Native dances. Some of the works shown at the event had a more somber message. They incorporated the red handprint that symbolizes missing and murdered Indigenous people. Designers and models were from Inupiaq, Tlingit, Yupik cultures, among others. Along with Schaefer, who is Director of Climate Initiatives at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, in addition to being an artist, the designers whose works were shown included Maria Shea Tala Williams of Southeast Alaska, Marissa Taylor of St. Lawrence Island, Carlene Thayer of Unalaska, Alana Moses of Fairbanks, and Christina Waska, originally from Newtok. The Arctic Encounter Symposium, which opened on April 15th, ran through April 17th. It has attracted attendees from 30 countries, Callender said. You've been listening to Native Sun on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Remember, you can always catch Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Music is Land Back by Hallucination. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.